Islamic Upbringing, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us and tuning in. If you have any questions, comments, or just some suggestions or feedback, you can, of course, contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, or you can also just visit our website, parstoday.com. Until another program, fi amanillah.
Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all, by the Lord of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way. It's a complete way.
Late July, Tunisian President Kais Saied invoked emergency powers, fired the Prime Minister and suspended Parliament for 30 days. In a televised address, he said the measures would remain in place until social peace returns to Tunisia. Long hailed as the only success story of the so-called Arab Spring uprisings, Tunisia now faces its most dangerous political crisis since the revolution a decade ago.
الحادث الحدث مؤلم جدا لجميع السعوديين.
The political turmoil has once again thrown into sharp relief the subversive roles of the Saudis and Emiratis in Tunisia. Well-informed Saudi sources have revealed financial promises made by the two Arab regimes to the Tunisian president. The Saudi whistleblower Mujtahid tweeted that Saudi Arabia and the UAE are prepared to give $5 billion to Saied if the coup, as he puts it, succeeds. Mujtahid has also revealed that Saudi Arabia and the UAE operated about 700,000 Facebook accounts, mostly fake, to incite against Parliament and support the so-called coup or turmoil.
And Hada, which is the largest party in the Parliament that was suspended, which is Brotherhood, it's Muslim Brotherhood related, they are against what they call Saeed's coup. Saeed is the president. Saeed suspended parliament. That is called a coup. And I agree that the Ennahda is not happy with Saeed's suspension of parliament.
An anonymous source privy to the Saudi court has recently told Saudi leaks that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman secretly called Saied prior to his controversial decision and encouraged him to dissolve the parliament so as to isolate the Ennahda of the Islamic Renaissance Party from the Tunisian political scene. Meanwhile, Anwar Gargesh, diplomatic advisor to the UAE president, met with Saied amidst the turmoil to voice his support for Saied. Ennahda, the biggest party in Tunisia's parliament, has consequently accused the UAE of playing a role in what the party calls Saied's power grab.
The UAE doesn't have... It's trying to throw its weight around. It's in Yemen. It's on Mars. It's on the moon. little tiny dictatorship throwing its weight around far beyond its position, its credible position.
Strangely enough, 3 days before Saeed's announcement, Tahir Khalfan Tamim, Dubai's deputy police chief, tweeted a cryptic message. Good news, a new blow, powerful, coming to the Brotherhood. A reference to Ennahda's links to the Muslim Brotherhood group.
Egypt is military, and they are very much in favor of overthrowing the Ennahda parliament in Tunisia. So I think that it's possible that Sisi in Egypt is actually behind pressuring Saeed, the president of Tunisia, to suspend parliament and then to keep it suspended. And basically, he can rule by decree. That is what Sisi is effectively doing in Egypt. And he doesn't like democracy. He doesn't like the Muslim Brotherhood.
Shortly after the Tunisian president's decision, U.S. Senator Chris Murphy called on the Biden administration to investigate the case. He tweeted, "What role are Saudi Arabia and UAE playing in the Tunisian crisis? The Biden administration should seek the answer to this question post-haste." Saeed's takeover had been covered favorably by media in Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Saudi Arabia's Okaz daily newspaper had an entire front page on Tunisia with the headline, "Tunisia rises up against the Brotherhood." For its part, the UAE has refrained from offering an official reaction to the recent development in Tunisia. But the Emirati news outlet 24 Media, for example, published a piece on the political crisis entitled "A Brave Decision to Save Tunisia."
And Ennahda is, as far as I understand, is not backed by Saudi Arabia. It is backed by Qatar. Qatar is the one that is backing the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and elsewhere. And they have been protecting Muslim Brotherhood. So I think that the Saudis are against Ennahda, and they do not like democracy. They are much like Sisi. Sisi and the Saudis are working together against the Ennahda in Tunisia. So that is the situation with the Saudis.
Abu Dhabi and Riyadh have both been highly critical of the Ennahda party, which formed a government after the 2011 revolution, as it has been described as an example of how political Islam and democracy could work together. Former Tunisian President Moncef Marzouki, who served from 2011 to 2014, said, "No doubt that the UAE is behind this coup." When it comes to subversive plots in Tunisia, Abu Dhabi in particular has been a fixture both in rumors and reports. Last year, it was reported that Turkish intelligence had foiled an attempted coup plot inside Tunisia, which was allegedly coordinated by the United Arab Emirates. Riyadh and Abu Dhabi have reportedly been using social media accounts to stir up anger online and drive the country further into chaos. In the words of Mark Owen Jones, a professor at Hamad bin Khalifa University in Doha, "To me, this is absolutely typical of Emirati and Saudi campaigns. It's almost like a classic signature of accounts you'd expect to see engaged in this type of behavior."
All the bad guys, US, Saudis, Sisi in Egypt, they are against the Brotherhood. In wherever it is, whether it's in Tunisia or Egypt or Syria, and they prefer a strong man in power, but there are other forces that are happy with instability. Now, I don't think the Saudis want instability in Tunisia. They would prefer an autocracy like they have. So I don't know who's really benefiting by what's happening now in Tunisia. I think it's very complex and unclear, and there's many factors and many actors. And if you want to divide it into good and bad, I will stand by supporting the Brotherhood as the forces basically of the people and the moderate forces and the uncorrupt forces.
It cannot be understated the insidious role the UAE and Saudi Arabia have been playing to stir up civil unrest in Tunisia. The two authoritarian regimes will not stop working to destabilize Tunisia, the symbol of a freedom-seeking nation in the entire Arab world.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha
Dear brothers and sisters, you are listening to the Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this special episode, we select a short part of Imam Khomeini's will. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his pure progeny, said, I leave two great and precious things among you, the Book of Allah and my household. Whether the pool refers to the stage of submergence of parts, kithrat in the whole, or wahdat, or the absorption of drops into the ocean or something else, lies beyond the domain of man's intellect and condition, one should add that same injustice of the oppressors towards these two trusts of Allah's messenger has been inflicted on the Muslim community, and upon humanity for that matter, which the pen is incapable of description.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode of Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Ayman Rizvi. In the last episode, we were talking about one of the speeches of Imam Khomeini, which was delivered on June 20th, 1982, to the leaders, the clergy, and the preachers of Qom. And in that speech, one important point I like to present it to you, that he mentioned that once the agents of Shah seized him in Qom, so those agents which were accompanying him in the car said, we had come for you, but these black tents, those tents set up especially during the month of Muharram to be used by mourners or passion, made us fear lest they become aware of our intention and we fail to do our duty. And I think it is a very important point for us to remember and to apply, especially during the Muharram and Safar, but also throughout the year probably, that we should use certain signs, for example, wearing black clothes. The color of the black has a special grandeur attached to it, a special significance attached to it, just because of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, because we are mourning for him in the months of Muharram and Safar. And even throughout the year, we are mourning different kinds of, you know, martyrdoms of different Aimma or the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.
These mourning processions with these special colors attached to it or with special signages attached to it, most of the time we have this elegy reciters who are explaining the events of Karbala in the way of poetry. These are all the different kinds of signs which can impress the enemies, which can create the notion of grandeur, the notion of amazingness, and the notion of anger among the people against the oppression. So I think this is very important thing which Imam Khomeini mentioned in his speech. And I think as mourners, we must have this notion in our mind, in our soul, and we should also practice it in our daily lives and especially in the morning gatherings and processions. Today's episode ends with this important lesson. Inshallah, till the next episode, fi amanillah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Around the world with reporters.
In an interview with the Al Khanadiq website, the head of Yemen's negotiating delegation for peace, Mohammed Abdus Salam, said the UK presence on Yemen soil is not new, and Yemenis reject any form of foreign presence on their land, and it is their right to fight those who come to invade the country militarily.
Since the beginning of the war, Yemeni people have rejected the foreign presence in any form and cannot accept that. We have made great sacrifices for our freedom and independence and to clean our land from foreign forces. Today, the world is following what is happening in Almara Governorate. People of Yemen cannot accept the Saudi British occupation of Almara, and we have come to the conviction that armed struggle is necessary to expel foreign forces, whether in Almara or elsewhere.
Regarding the developments in Marib, Abdus Salam said the liberated areas from forces backed by the Saudi-led military coalition in the Western Governorate are equal to the size of two Persian Gulf states. The chief negotiator added that battles are still going on in Marib and other fronts. He said the recent initiative offered by Yemen's Ansarullah movement is the key to end the war that the coalition started against Yemen in 2015, but Saudis have no real intentions to move politically. However, he noted that the initiative is still in force.
The other party must accept the initiative presented by Ansarullah because it establishes a comprehensive political solution. The other party will regret it if they didn't respond to this initiative because it aims to stop the war completely and end the suffering of Yemenis. Unfortunately, Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates are the ones who have took the power to decide, and we are ready to talk with the Yemeni parties if they have enough courage to take action by themselves.
Recently, the Saudi-led coalition has intensified its air raids on Marib in what experts describe as a desperate attempt to back the Saudi-backed forces on the ground as the Yemeni army keeps marking new advances toward the city of Marib.
Experts believe that Ansarullah has the upper hand as the Yemeni army keeps advancing toward the city of Marib. They say Ansarullah's initiative is a great opportunity for Riyadh to get rid of the quagmire it's stuck with its war on Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Seoul Metropolitan Government's Yongsan City Memorial Exhibition Hall is holding an exhibit, July 16th Yongsan. It shows footage for the first time in South Korea of the July 16th, 1950 U.S. bombing of Yongsan, Central Seoul's district, which killed hundreds of civilians.
U.S. B-29 bombers sent to destroy military targets like Yongsan Station switchyard also hit civilian buildings. 3 weeks before, on June 25th, the Korean War had broken out and North Korean forces had crossed the 38th parallel, capturing Seoul just 3 days later.
The footage obtained from the U.S. National Archives and Records Administration shows bombs being dropped and bodies strewn on the ground. Videos and photos edited from it are organized under four themes to highlight wartime suffering and healing after the 1953 armistice.
The bombing killed at least 1,587 of Yongsan's 193,000 residents, and 47 B-29 bombers dropped some 1,500 bombs, as this bomber was highly inaccurate and had to drop many bombs.
The event draws many curious visitors from Seoul and Greater Seoul's smaller cities and towns.
I'm glad the footage was released. Forgetting this incident would be a tragedy. We should not ignore or hide an unexpectedly large number of civilian deaths an aerial bombing unintentionally caused.
West of Seoul in Incheon, General Douglas MacArthur's statue overlooks the port where he led the famed September 1950 landing that led to the South recovering Seoul.
Some people criticize him because he did not take, at least this is what they say, enough care to minimize civilian casualties during the bombing of Yongsan Station in 1950.
In his latest speech on the anniversary of Korea's liberation from Japan's colonial rule at World War II's end, the same day Korea was divided, the South's president urged inter-Korean peace, the exhibit's underlying message.
East and West Germany achieved unification after 45 years. Division is the biggest obstacle to our growth and prosperity, a tenacious barrier to permanent peace. Like Germany, we can remove it.
The exhibit, which opened recently on the anniversary of the bombing and will run at least until this year's end, serves as a powerful reminder war must never happen on the Korean Peninsula again. Jennifer Chang, Seoul.
As part of a new plot to seize further Palestinian lands, the Jewish National Fund, a Zionist organization, has initially agreed to allocate $100 million to register the Palestinian lands in East Al-Quds and the West Bank in name of settlers. The new plan could lead to the eviction of further Palestinians from their homes in the West Bank and East Al-Quds. According to Israeli Peace Now Group,
The establishment is encouraging settlers to confiscate more Palestinian lands. The piece now noted that the right-wing regime of Israel is seeking to seize more Palestinian lands through the Jewish National Fund.
This regime will do anything in its power to first expand settlements and second to annex more Palestinian areas. And now, with the help of this gang establishment known as the Jewish National Fund, Bennett's regime is working to achieve his goal, that is to back illegal settlement construction.
The fund covers about 17,000 properties, most of them inhabited by Palestinians. Observers say this is the same scenario carried out earlier in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in Al-Quds. Palestinian families are fighting legal battles to prove their ownership of the properties amid Israeli efforts to evacuate them forcefully from their homes.
The policy has been adopted many times in the past. Today, the Zionist organization is seeking to forge documents and displace more Palestinians both in West Bank and Al-Quds. They are after imposing their full control over the holy city.
The Jewish National Fund is a Zionist organization founded in 1901 to buy and develop land in Ottoman and Mandatory Palestine for Jewish settlers. Earlier this year, Israeli media reported that Israeli authorities recruited the Jewish National Fund to secretly buy Palestinian land for settlers. Palestinians warn that the move by the Jewish National Fund is another proof for Israel's attempts to illegally seize more land in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds by forced expulsion of real owners. They say, however, that they will never back down and they will continue resisting these Israeli plans. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
The second day of the conference vote sessions in Iran's parliament started with reviewing the credentials of Ebrahim Raisi's pick for ICT Minister Issa Zarepour. As is the rule, two pros and two cons speak for or against the nominee, who will then defend his credentials for 30 minutes.
I am proud to announce that during my term in the Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance, I launched hundreds of science-based firms. Thanks to these efforts in 2011, we exported $20 million worth of software to other countries.
Mr. Zarepour does not have the expertise to run the ICT ministry. Furthermore, he does not have a fixed approach toward Parliament's bill on the protection of cyberspace. He has repeatedly flip-flopped on the issue. Mr. Zarepour, I ask you to clarify your stance. Do you agree or disagree with the cyberspace protection bill?
By the cyberspace protection bill, the legislator refers to a controversial bill recently introduced in Parliament that seeks to fill the legal voids in the Internet. Some believe if passed into law, the new bill would restrict the activities of cyber users, and others say it would ensure the intellectual property of online businesses in Iran.
The bill is yet to be passed into law and is pending now. I think if it becomes law, it will organize cyberspace in our country. It will protect the rights of online users. It will prevent cybercrimes. Every country has such a law. It's for the good of our people.
I think the draft bill needs to be revised. I do agree that there are serious legal voids with regards to cyberspace in our country, but could the new bill be implemented in a way that it would not make people worry about their online activities?
The credentials of the proposed ministers of intelligence, economy, and health were also put to debate on Sunday. Parliament had scheduled to review at least five nominees each day to wrap up the process by Tuesday. But after 2 days, lawmakers have managed to examine only five of the 19 ministerial picks.
While lawmakers have vowed to wrap up the vote of confidence session swiftly, they're already behind schedule. They argue that this is because they're trying to be meticulous in studying the qualifications of the nominees. And this, they say, will lead to a new cabinet that has the least friction with people's representatives. Yusuf Jalali from Iran's parliament.
The National and Islamic Forces in the Gaza Strip commemorated the 52nd anniversary of Al-Aqsa Mosque burning by holding a huge rally along the separating border East Gaza. Al-Aqsa Mosque was burned by an extremist Jew in 1969. Palestinian factions expressed their condemnation of Israel's long history of crimes against Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Today marks the 52nd anniversary of the burning of Al-Aqsa Mosque. This incident shows the true nature of this occupation. Palestinians here vow to continue their battle against this occupation across all occupied lands. We remain united in this endless battle with all possible means.
This rally comes in conjunction with the current Israeli violations in Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque, where Israeli regime is imposing the policy of eviction and displacement of Palestinians and keeping their killing and land-grabbing operations in an attempt to Jewidize Al-Quds and get rid of its people.
Palestinians have gathered here to assert the unity of all Palestinians in the face of occupation. Palestinians are here to say no to any Israeli attempts to Judaize the Palestinian lands. Palestinians won't accept any violation against Al-Quds, and the resistance will go on until liberation of all Palestine.
The resistance declared it won't allow Israel to violate Palestinian sanctities and keep the blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip, as they agreed to activate the popular resistance and the return of clashes by the separation fence, stressing they won't remain silent over the Israeli crimes.
Palestinians have proved that they will keep their resistance in the face of all Israeli projects that aim to demolish the Palestinian identity. Al-Quds is the symbol of our history. Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque are our red lines, and we won't accept any Israeli violation of our holy sites. Israeli regime must be held accountable for any action against Al-Quds.
52 years after Al-Aqsa Mosque was set ablaze, Palestinians here call for defending Al-Quds with all possible means until its complete freedom from occupation. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Taliban leaders are busy in these days as they are facing the challenge of good governance in Afghanistan. To this end, they have decided to pick up some key steps to prove their capabilities by unveiling a new framework for governance within next days. The Taliban say they aim to keep up consultations with former high-ranking officials, prominent political leaders, and the rest of political activists in order to establish an inclusive government.
We want to establish a government in which all sides, including political groups, ethnic groups, and religious groups, have their share in. We are trying to reach an agreement with other sides in this regard. We are not after war. We are seeking peace and calm for our country.
In the meantime, top Afghan political leaders urged the Taliban to continue its efforts to attract more local and international support. This will not happen, they warn, unless the Taliban listen to the voice of people.
I do not expect the peace plan developed entirely by the U.S. to be fruitful. Therefore, regional countries need to take the initiative and work together on the issue, or at least put pressure on the U.S. to work honestly.
Taliban war comes as thousands of Afghans seek to get out of their country via Kabul International Airport since Taliban took control over the city almost a week ago. The rising number of horrified people in and around the airport has created a big chaos there, resulting to the death of 12 so far. Two of the victims, including a member of Afghanistan's national football team, lost their lives after they fell from this flying U.S. military aircraft. The incident shocked the entire world. Taliban say they plan to investigate reported cases of atrocities by their members against civilians, including journalists. Taliban are going to set up separate teams for dealing with Afghanistan's internal security and financial crisis as well. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen is worsening amid the ongoing Saudi war and siege. A recent report by the United Nations Population Fund suggests that 20.7 million Yemenis require humanitarian assistance, while over a million pregnant and breastfeeding women are projected to suffer from acute malnutrition throughout 2021. The COVID-19 pandemic, along with the torrential rain and the currency collapse, has also contributed to the deterioration of the already catastrophic humanitarian situation in Yemen, the report said. For instance, by the the end of June 2021, nearly 7,000 cases of COVID-19 and more than 1,300 associated deaths had been reported amid concerns that the real number of infections were being underreported. Earlier, the United Nations reported that it had only received half of what was required for the humanitarian response plan of 2021, which was estimated at $3.85 million, despite donors stepping up their support compared to 2020.
Observers say Yemen will continue to face a devastating humanitarian situation that risks turning into famine if the international community does not act urgently. They say the only solution is to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege imposed on millions of Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The UK government came under immense fire today after MPs condemned the catastrophic British failures in Afghanistan. During Wednesday's parliamentary debate on the subject, Boris Johnson desperately attempted to convince MPs that Britain's withdrawal wasn't chaotic at all, but with little success.
Mr. Speaker, I think it would be fair to say that the events in Afghanistan have unfolded and the collapse has been faster than I think even the Taliban themselves predicted. What is not true is to say that the UK government was unprepared or did not foresee this.
Before the debate even started, anti-war Labour MPs gathered outside Westminster with anti-war veteran Jeremy Corbyn to denounce British foreign policy.
Many of the MPs who have been supportive of the continued war and occupation in Afghanistan will be sitting today during this debate, which has already begun. Now, this will be very awkward for them, as many of the anti-war MPs who have criticised British foreign policy, particularly in Afghanistan for many, many years, have been proven right following the latest developments in Afghanistan.
British military failures was not the only focus of criticism. Concern over the lack of willingness to help Afghan refugees was expressed too. For the time being, the UK is refusing to recognise the Taliban's administration, but have agreed to accept some refugees, but only time will tell if Britain will honour this pledge or not. Robert Carter, London.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and German Chancellor Angela Merkel held talks in the Kremlin. This is their last summit meeting as heads of state because Merkel will not participate in the upcoming parliamentary elections in Germany. Her farewell visit took place on the anniversary of the alleged poisoning of opposition leader Alexei Navalny.
Despite the fact that we have different opinions, I think it is good that we talk to each other and we intend to keep in touch further.
After the meeting with the Russian president, Merkel called on Putin to release Navalny. Putin, however, said the fight against corruption should not be used as an instrument of political struggle, adding the opposition figure was convicted not for his political activities, but for criminal offenses against foreign partners. The two also touched upon the situation in Afghanistan. Putin said Moscow's priority is to prevent terrorists from entering neighboring countries under the guise of refugees.
We know Afghanistan, and we know how this country is organized and how counterproductive it is to try to impose unusual forms of government and public life on it. Any such socio-political experiments have never been successful and led only to the destruction of states, degradation of their political and social systems.
In addition to bilateral relations, the fight against the coronavirus pandemic, the conflict in eastern Ukraine, the situation in Belarus, as well as Nord Stream 2 and the role of Ukraine as a transit country for Russian gas were discussed.
Merkel managed to defend the Nord Stream. The Americans pressed on her. Germany needs Russian energy. Regarding the situation in Afghanistan, here Germany fully listened to what the Americans were saying, and now Germany has received it in full. The Americans are living in an ugly way, having substituted all their allies in the NATO alliance. This once again showed that Germans that it's absurd to rely on the U.S. America's visit shows that the stake on in America is doubly wrong, and Germany during the reign of Merkel has repeatedly succumbed to influence from overseas.
On August 22nd, Merkel will fly to Kyiv. Putin asked her to influence the country's authorities to fulfill all obligations on Donbas. Berlin has always been one of Moscow's main partners in politics and economics. The Russian president expressed hope that with the new leadership in Germany, in the near future, it would be possible to continue the dialogue on resolving the conflict in southeastern Ukraine. Марина Картунова, Moscow.
Turkey says it will decide on Taliban's government recognition after it is formed. Turkish foreign minister said Ankara will not rush into recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan as it is still too early for this step.
We are keeping up dialogue with all sides, including the Taliban. We view positively the messages that the Taliban have given so far, whether to foreigners, diplomatic individuals, or its own people. We hope to see these in action as well.
In response to a question regarding Turkey's contact with the Taliban, Çavuşoğlu said Turkey had invited the political wing of the Taliban to Turkey before they had entered Kabul. Earlier, Turkish security sources said Ankara had dropped plans to guard and operate Kabul's airport after the withdrawal of NATO forces from Afghanistan, following footage and reports of chaos taking place there after Taliban's takeover. Turkey says its offer to provide technical and security assistance at the Kabul airport will be further discussed with the U.S.
Turkey will follow the lead of other countries in recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan. If the U.S. and EU countries recognize a government formed by Taliban, Turkey will follow in their footsteps. However, I don't think that Turkey will consider the Taliban government as a strategic partner in the region. We expect a delegation from the Taliban to visit Turkey for talks over the transition phase, just like it is taking place with other countries in the region.
The Turkish president had announced last week his readiness to meet with the Taliban leadership. Turkey says so far the Taliban is sending positive messages, hoping that it will be followed with positive actions as well. Turkey is now concerned about the refugee influx it is going to have after Taliban's takeover in Afghanistan. This comes as it has been struggling to revive the economic situation in the country with a handful of refugees already there amid the coronavirus pandemic. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
In the limelight.
When an Israeli regime troop shoots a Palestinian child in the head or a Palestinian teenager or demonstrator or plumber through the heart, Israeli society is mute and apathetic, says Gideon Levy, writer, in an article titled "In Occupied Territories, Cold-Blooded Killing of Palestinians is Met with Silence." Stay tuned for more. Scores of unarmed Palestinians, including children, have been murdered since the end of the Zionist regime's May assault. Yet this is now so normal. The Israeli regime media and army barely mention it. Superficially, things are relatively quiet these days in the Israeli-occupied territories. There are no Israeli casualties, almost no attacks in the West Bank, and certainly not inside the occupied territories. Gaza has been quiet since the end of the Israeli regime's latest offense there, Operation Guardian of the Walls. In the West Bank, the despair-inducing routine of daily life grinds on during this so-called period of quiet, which is precisely the irony crying out for the notice in this terrifying statistic. Since May, more than 40 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank. In a single week at the end of July, the Israeli regime military killed 4 Palestinians, one of them a child of 12. 2 of the 40 were from one village, Beita, which lately has lost 6 of its residents. 5 were unarmed protesters and 1 was a plumber reportedly summoned to fix a faucet somewhere. None of the 4 killed in late July posed any threat to the lives of any Israeli troop or settler. Using live ammunition against any of these people were prohibited, never mind aiming to kill, as did the Israeli regime soldiers who shot them. 4 human beings, or, if you prefer, 40 human beings with families whose world was shattered, people with plans and dreams and loves, all suddenly ended by some young Israeli regime troop, so casually and so brutally. In case all that is not enough, note this. The Israeli regime media hardly covered these killings. Neither of the Israeli regime's two leading newspapers mentioned the killing of the 12-year-old boy in Beit Omar between Beit Lahm and Al-Khalil, nor did either of the two most important commercial television stations bother to report it. Put another way, the killing of a boy of 12, Muhammad Al-Alami, who had been shopping with his father and sister when Israeli regime troops leveled a stream of bullets into the family's car, killing the boy, who, like his father, had done nothing wrong. This was evidently deemed by some Israeli regime media a story of no importance and no interest. There is no other way to explain this widespread inattention to an act of murder. Consider also that all those murders since May were barely reported, never mind investigated, and you get a picture of the Israeli regime's repression and denial of the occupation via the media's version of Iron Dome, courtesy of the free press in all its wretchedness. Protected by a silenced media, Israelis were spared this ugly picture of their army and its brutal modus operandi. Protected by that silence, denial, and repression, even Israeli regime politicians and generals were not made to explain or even address the fact that rarely a week goes by in the occupied territories without Palestinian casualties, even during this relatively quiet period. If the troops were to shoot the stray animals as casually as they shoot Palestinians, there would be public howls of outrage, and the troops would be tried and severely punished. Thus, until a few days ago, no army commander had issued any criticism of the behavior of these troops, let alone any mention of bringing charges or opening a serious investigation. Only after a series of articles and editorials in Haaretz did Commander-in-Chief Lieutenant General Aviv Kochavi communicate a request to lower the temperature. Not an order, a request, no charges, and no investigation. Just a vague declaration of good intentions for the future. Behind all this is contempt for Palestinian lives. Nothing is valued less in the occupied territories called Israel than the life of a Palestinian. Draw a straight line from the construction workers falling like flies to their death at building sites in occupied territories with nobody to care, to the unarmed protesters in the occupied territories fatally shot by Israeli regime troops, why nobody bats an eye. One common factor unites them all: the conviction in occupied territories that Palestinian lives are cheap. If the troops were to shoot the stray animals as casually as they shoot Palestinians, there would be public howls of outrage, and the troops would be tried and severely punished. But they are only killing Palestinians, so what's the problem? When an Israeli troop shoots a Palestinian child in the head, or a Palestinian teenager, or demonstrator, or plumber through the heart, Israeli regime society is mute and apathetic. It makes do with the flimsy explanations and sometimes outrage lies provided by the Israeli regime army spokesperson, omitting any expression of moral qualms about the need to kill. So many of these fatalities have been investigated and documented and written about in the newspaper have evoked no particular interest. Shadi Omar Lutfi Salim, 41, a prosperous plumber who lived in Beita in the central West Bank, left home on the evening of July 24th, heading for the main road where the mains valve to the village water supply was located, after someone evidently discovered a problem there. He parked his Jeep alongside the road and walked back toward the valve, a red monkey wrench in his hand. It was 10:30 p.m. As he neared the valve, Israeli regime troops in the vicinity suddenly opened fire and fatally shot him. They later claimed that he had run toward them holding a metal bar. The only metal bar was a red monkey wrench left behind on the ground alongside his packet of cigarettes and a blood stain, already dry when people got there a few days after his death. One week later, in the same village, troops killed Ahmad Ali Duwekat, 37, a construction laborer, father of four young daughters and a two-month-old baby. This was during the village weekly Friday protest. Beita residents had been demonstrating weekly for the last 2 months or so against the establishment of a rogue outpost on village land. The settlement, Givat Evitar, was erected unofficially and then emptied of its residents by the Zionist regime, but 40 structures rapidly built there were not demolished. The land has been returned to its owners, who are not allowed to come near it. Since Givat Evitar was launched over 10 weeks ago, 5 Palestinian protesters have already been killed there by the Zionist regime troops. None of the 5 was close enough to endanger the troops in any way, even as demonstrators were throwing stones and burning tires to protest against the takeover of their land. The residents are determined to continue resisting until their lands will return to them. And meanwhile, the blood flows week after week. The Wakeout was drinking a glass of water when an Israeli regime sniper chose him, apparently at random, and shot him through the heart from a distance of several hundred meters. The bullet exploded inside his body, damaging his internal organs, and Duwekat died on the spot, blood pouring from his mouth. His baby boy, Ali, was made an orphan soon after his birth. A few weeks earlier, the Zionist regime troops shot teenager Muhammad Munir al-Tamimi from another protesting village, Nabi Saleh, and killed him. Tamimi was 17 and became his small village fifth fatality in the last few years. Everyone in the community belongs to the Tamimi family, and for years now, they have been resisting the theft of their lands by the surrounding settlements. These deaths were all executions. There is no other way to describe them. Shooting unarmed protesters, teenagers, children, a plumber, a construction laborer, people demonstrating publicly in the quest to regain their property and their freedom is a crime. Even the grumbling head here and there and the systematic killing has to do with whether it might lead to a deterioration in the situation overall. On the question of the legality and especially the morality of the matter of innocence, nobody says a word. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters.
7,410 kHz for Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.